Illinois faces some big challenges. Today, you're about to hear a truly honest analysis of the problems we face. Equally important, you'll also hear an in-depth discussion of some practical solutions. This is your radio source for stories, insight, and the answers you won't hear anywhere else. Not in the media, and not coming from Springfield. You're listening to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute. Now, here's your host, Dan Proft.
Welcome to another edition of Illinois Rising. You can catch me Monday to Friday, 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Amy Jacobson on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. And joining me for this edition is Ted Dabrowski. He's the Vice President of Policy for the Illinois Policy Institute. Ted, great to have you again.
Thank you. So
the school year has started in Chicago, and with the advent of the school year comes another rite of fall, which is the Chicago Teachers Union threatening a strike. And apparently we have a date set of September 21st where the Chicago Teachers Union, under the stewardship of Karen Lewis, I'll just say Karen Lewis, is not going to accept the budget that was advanced by the administration, which would include a phase out of the Chicago public school system, picking up the teachers' contribution to their pensions. This is the stumbling block. This is the issue over which Karen Lewis has threatened that she is prepared to strike and seems to be serious about that.
Was deja vu. You know, we were talking about this in 2012. Chicago public school system was already a mess. It was already facing billion-dollar deficits. Results, you know, were as poor as they've been. And here the teachers' union was about to strike and put such stress on the system that here we are 4 years later. It's nearly bankrupt, and here they go again.
For a broader perspective on the issue, we're happy to be joined by Dan DeSalvo. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He's also a poli-sci professor at the City College of New York and author of the book Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences. Dan, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure to be with you.
So so here's the thing. Karen Lewis and the Chicago Teachers Union is threatening another strike because they know if they strike, they're going to have the support of the parents, and they're going to have the support of all of those who just dislike Rahm Emanuel. And they're going to have their way with the city administration the same way they did 4 years ago. So why not continue to demand the unreasonable because they're used to getting it?
Well, that's certainly they've certainly walked themselves right up to the brink of a strike. And now that they've put this authorization vote on the table as a pressure tactic, as negotiations continue, it doesn't, unless something changes, it looks like Chicago is on course for another strike sometime in October.
Dan, I'd like to understand from you, and you know, you've studied this a lot. What makes the CTU brand of unionism so, we call it here, militant? What makes them so special that they can, you know, this will be the third strike when you count the short strike earlier. What makes it so special? Why are they different from other unions?
Well, in some sense, the first thing to think about in this case is this is a public employee union. So in that sense, it's very different from the private sector where, you know, there's some market constraints on demands. Here, there's no market. There's a virtual monopoly of a public service, and teachers enjoy many more job protections than private sector employees do. So there's not much to constrain the demands. And as the teachers unions themselves put it, we can always just get more revenue. So in that sense, they're like other unions in the sense that they always want more. It's really the teachers union's job is to represent their members and win them the best deal on pay, benefits, and working conditions. So it's not to, you know, they're not out there to pursue the interests of parents or to pursue the interests first and foremost of students. They're out there to pursue first and foremost the material interests of the teachers. And that, when the chips are down as they are now in Chicago, that's really about more money and job protections.
But it's really difficult to break through, it seems, and thus the success of the teachers unions and their political influence, because you have so many families that have a personal relationship with their teachers in a way they don't necessarily have that kind of personal relationship with, you know, frontline employees of other public sector union workers and other units of government. Their kid goes to this school, and I know the teacher, and we have a relationship, and I like that teacher, and I want that teacher to be employed, and I want my kid to be in school. And so, you know, kind of look past some of the inexorably problematic math of salaries and benefits, because you've got this personal relationship and your teacher is there saying, hey, you know, I don't want to do this. I want to be in the classroom educating your children, but the politicians are treating us unfairly. You know, who's going to win that argument?
That's right. Teachers are much more sympathetic than many other public groups, public employees, certainly police officers, for example, would be the other end of the spectrum, where they have a naturally adversarial relationship with, you know, the communities that they have to patrol in some way. So teachers have this more sympathetic thing. The fact that they're public employees and they're teachers leads to the rhetoric that you often hear from Karen Lewis and other teacher union leaders, which is what's good for teachers is good for kids, that they're interests coincide. If teachers are well paid and happy, that will rebound to the benefit of kids, even if there isn't much evidence to support this chiming of interest between the two groups. It is a persuasive rhetoric that leads people to sort of look, as you say, look past many of the tough financial decisions that are confronting, you know, an entity on the verge of bankruptcy, which is the Chicago Public Schools.
So Dan, what should happen? You know, you've got a situation where the parents strongly supported the teachers last time around in 2012. Now, since then, things have gotten worse. We've had school shutterings. We've had these, you know, gang protection areas. It's a mess. It's a mess any way you look at it. At what point or how will the parents finally figure out that what the unions are doing is against the parents' interest? Or does something else have to happen to finally get there?
Well, just start with the strike proposal. A strike is, once you call it and once teachers walk out, you know, now it's a good pressure tactic. Now they have the support of parents. But if you're on strike for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, how long can the teachers go before losing the support of parents as they scramble to come up with childcare alternatives and balance work and family every day? So for the teachers, there's something of a time limit on how much they can enjoy, you know, the full-throated support of parents. And that's why a strike is always a really uncertain gamble for any union, but especially the teachers union, because all the things that benefit them, those connections to parents and to communities, that then puts them in that directly adversarial relationship with parents and with communities.
But how do you change this paradigm like we have in Chicago, the Chicago public school system, and this public sector union, the teachers union, essentially running the school system and running over the politicians? I mean, do you essentially have to have at some point a civilian political leadership that is willing to take a page out of Ronald Reagan's book and replace striking teachers, or move in that direction of replacing striking teachers, to send a message that you know, this is real, and there are a lot of other talented people that want to be in education, and we're going to find them, and we're going to replace you, because, as my high school basketball coach used to tell me, the graveyards are full of indispensable people.
Right, I think, you know, certainly the governor, your governor in Illinois, Governor Rauner, has put some measures that would allow for greater flexibility and sort of recalibrate the balance between unions, especially public employee unions on one side, and the state or the local political authorities on the other, that is moving in a direction of more right-to-work laws. You could change collective bargaining laws. Right now, the political alignments at the state level, which would really be required to, you know, change the nature of the collective bargaining game that's really privileged the Chicago's teacher union right now at the state level, obviously, is a major impasse.
Right. And is another possibility to look, you know, just looking around at other states. One of the ways to do that is just to introduce competition and open the floodgates. So Florida, for example, with their tax credit program that has now $500 million worth of monies for scholarships to kids, for kids to get out of failing schools and to have the same choice that wealthier and more politically connected families have. Maybe that's one of the ways to dilute some of the concentration of power, isn't it?
That's right. You know, you could see one of the negotiating points is to try to, that the teachers unions in Chicago, in Illinois, and elsewhere, in my home state of New York, is to constrict the number and growth of charter schools, which would be another source of competition to reduce their monopoly. And that's been a subject of the bargain, which between CPS and CTU over putting a cap on the growth of charters. They don't want those to grow. So that, again, requires, you know, political will and a kind of counter force that's going to do that.
He is Dan DeSalvo. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, poli-sci professor at the City College of New York, and the author of the book Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences. Dan, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
We now return to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute, the radio show discussing the honest truth about Illinois policy and politics. Here's Dan Proft.
Dan Proft back with Ted Dabrowski, Vice President of Policy at the Illinois Policy Institute, on this edition of Illinois Rising. And Ted, talking about teacher pensions specifically, a bit of an event this past week where the Illinois Teachers Retirement System, or TRS, had revised down its assumed rate of return on investments from 7.5% to 7%, which you think, oh, that's 0.5 of a point. What's the big deal? I'll tell you what the big deal is. It means taxpayers are on the hook for another $421 million in pension contributions in 2017 alone. The whole gambit of assumed rate of return for these pension funds is a whole other aspect of talking about public sector pension reform that is kind of under-discussed and underappreciated, isn't it?
Well, it is. You know, we talk about how expensive these pensions are, how they're guaranteeing payments for lifetime for workers. But the real problem with them is the underlying assumptions that are made in order to be able to make those payments. And what TRS did this past week kind of shows how messed up those systems are, that they're based on these assumptions that can't be met, that are really hard to meet, and that show that the problem or the hole that taxpayers are under is huge, much bigger than we ever thought of.
Because they're not generating 7.5% return, they're not generating 7% return, and to the extent that they try, they put money into
junk bonds.
Right,
and,
risky investments.
Yeah.
And so now you're like the problem gambler chasing.
Well, this is beautiful, right? Because if you manage these pension funds, you take big risks, you try to do, you know, high-risk bonds, high-risk real estate, and if they get it right, they get to act like heroes, that they can fund pensions. But if they get it wrong, they've got a backstop, which is the taxpayer. They just come back and get the taxpayers to bail them out. And that's what's fundamentally unfair about this whole thing.
Right, and what they should be doing, what pension fund managers should be doing, is like what wealth managers do for high-net-worth clients. I'm not really in the rate of return business. I'm in the wealth protection business. So I'm not here to take huge risks. I'm here to make sure you maintain and grow at a consistent, steady pace that's rational, right? So you don't have these wild swings.
Well, one more way to say this is if the pension funds and the state want to guarantee something to the workers, state workers, then they should invest in something that's guaranteed to give them guaranteed returns.
Oh.
And that way, you know, it's matched. It's perfect.
Well, right.
That's not what happens. Yeah. It's the opposite way.
I don't think T-bills are going to return 7%.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's the problem.
Well, for more on this, we're happy to be joined by Mark Lennon, who is a expert in this area as well. He writes for WirePoints, wirepoints.com. Mark, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. Thank you.
So you argued in WirePoints that why not take the rate down to where it really should be in terms of the expected rate of return, something like 1.5% to 2.5%. Well, if we did that, then we would all pack up and leave Illinois because you think the numbers are astronomical and unfundable now. If we looked at the numbers with those kind of assumed rates of return, then, you know, it's all over, isn't it?
Well, it would shock the system into action. It would be a bold move, but it doesn't automatically mean that there will be a tax increase. These changes in the return assumptions do drive the required contribution. But look, the money's going to be owed anyway. These assumptions only drive the temporary calculations of how much has to be put in. So we're really only talking about whether we deal with reality now versus later, and the sooner the better, because this issue compounds, literally. That's the way the numbers work. So perhaps if we get the real numbers out there once and for all, and it would, unquestionably would be truthful to take the number way down, then we'd perhaps shock the system into some action and get some real reform going.
Hey, Mark, Ted here. You know, a few years ago, we actually started writing on this, and we said if the pension funds were more realistic in their assumptions and brought them back to the levels, you know, 3-4%, or, you know, even lower, we said that the amount of debt the taxpayers would be facing would be much, much higher. We were called alarmist back then, but that seemed to change, right? You've got a lot of groups calling for that now. And what does that mean for the amount of total debt that Illinois has, which officially today is about $111 billion? What does that become?
Just pension debt.
Just pension and just at the state level,
right.
Ignoring Chicago, ignoring
right.
all the cities.
It'll at least double the pension debt, at least, I mean, at a minimum. An actuary told me that as a rough estimate, you could bump up the unfunded liability by about 15% for every point that you drop the rate of return. I'm not sure if that's exactly accurate, but the numbers are clearly unfathomable. You can't meet them. We're not going to pay this. So it doesn't matter a whole lot whether it's double or triple what we have now.
Well, see, that's the challenge, isn't it? Because, you know, people hear $111 billion in unfunded pension liabilities that might as well be $111 trillion. I mean, these are silly numbers that are unfathomable. There's little context given to them. And also, there's been a lot of individuals, I mean, rightly based on the numbers, saying, you know, the end is near. But it seems there's a lot of people, particularly the beneficiaries, that don't want to believe the end is near until it actually comes to pass. And so is the real way out not to precipitate tax increases to fund a more accurate reflection of the unfunded liabilities, but rather to have one of these pension funds, say a city of Chicago police or fire pension funds that are less than 30% funded, to have them just unable to pay current beneficiaries, to seize up and literally have that kind of crisis at some point in the not too distant future. Is that probably the only way you can actually crystallize this issue in such a way that'll force people to act?
There are other possibilities, I suppose, but this would be one clear way to shock the system. You use exactly the right phrase in kind of your presumption there about whether there's a presumption that you'd have to raise taxes to do this. That would be a separate question, and I don't think the public would stand for that. Rauner understandably said, well, why throw more taxpayer money into a bottomless pit?
Right.
And taxpayers might be coming around to that, and there is a shift even in the attitude of the pensioners and the unions. They traditionally have lobbied for higher rates to try to disguise the problem, but now they're kind of recognizing that maybe they're not going to get paid, so they ought to kind of force the hand themselves now. And so they supported that decrease at TRS. And the way these reform proposals are set up in Chicago, you know, after 5 years, the pension gets to choose the actuary, and the tax increases are automatic in Chicago for the police and fire pension to cover whatever is actuarially required. So those unions are going to have every incentive to lower these rates of return, and they're going to control the system and impose automatic tax increases.
So I get this question all the time, and you guys are both better positioned to answer that than I am, Mark and Ted. And that is, so when does it happen? You know, we talk about these pension funds that are underfunded. When is it actually going to happen, according to the actuarial tables, that one of these pension funds is going to be unable to pay current beneficiaries, and then you're going to have, you know, a real manifestation of what we've been talking about for years now? You hear people say, oh, it's 5 years away, it's 7 years away, it's 10 years away, depending on the pension fund. The pension funds that you've looked at, I mean, is anything like what I'm suggesting is going to come to pass in the near term, in the offing in the near term?
Roughly 7 years, the Chicago pensions will bled out last time I measured it. Other systems, of course, are much closer to that. Kankakee, St. Louis, many of these have, you know, 20%, 15% funding now, and the municipality is bankrupt. There's not a whole lot of magic about what happens, though, when it bleeds down to zero. Then it becomes a liability of the municipality. And you know, we'll see what happens then. The municipality's not going to be able to pay. Pensioners will go off and sue the municipality. I think they're going to discover that all the assets are already mortgaged up in favor of bondholders, and there's not going to be anything for them to execute on. So, you know, that's always the question, Dan, is when an insolvency problem becomes a cash flow wall that you hit. It's hard to predict. It could be 3 years from now. In many cases, many municipalities, I think it will be shorter than that, but it could be 7 years from now.
Mark, you know, I totally agree with what you're saying. And I think, you know, looking at Chicago, and if you look at Chicago police and fire pensions, they're officially about 30 to 25% funded. But if you start lowering these discount rates or their expected investment returns, they're going to be more like 15% funded,
right.
meaning that they hardly have any money to meet their obligations. And I think what's missing from this whole thing is the next recession. You know, when does that come? You know, we've had a pretty good stock market rally since the Great Recession. And, you know, not only if you take a recession, lower tax revenues coming in, but also lower stock markets. Wow. I think that whole Chicago police and fire might really come to fruition. And then the question is going to be, do the unions want to then negotiate something better? You know, will they fight for tax increases, or will they realize, hey, we can't call for tax increases in a recession, so we better start giving something up? I think that's the question.
Or do we bring Kevin Orr in from Detroit, and he's not just the city manager, he's the state of Illinois manager for all these mini Detroits that we have bubbling up on the landscape. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Mark Glennon from WirePoints, wirepoints.com. Mark, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Now, more of Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute, the only show directly addressing the problems and solutions for Illinois. Now, here's Dan Proft.
Dan Proft back with Ted Dabrowski, Vice President of Policy at the Illinois Policy Institute, illinoispolicy.org. And Ted, we've talked about teacher pensions and police fire pensions. Probably talk about politicians' pensions and why do they have them? Well, Governor Bruce Rauner asked himself that question, and he's got a partial answer. He signed a bill into law last week that will make future county board members no longer eligible for pensions, no longer eligible for the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund. Existing board members will still be, as the Illinois Constitution of course, forbids clawing back, but future county board members. So that's a baby step in the right direction, it seems to me. This was the brainchild of a recently minted state representative, Republican out of Grundy County, Morris to be specific, David Welter. And Representative Welter joins us now. David, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So this idea of eliminating pensions for county board members kind of was your brainchild, as I mentioned, and this was a proposal you brought forward while you were on the Grundy County Board, ultimately serving as its county board chairman prior to taking the appointment to the legislative seat. What was the impetus for the idea?
Yeah, that's correct. So from time to time, IRM Ref will go around to the local counties and do audits of their pension programs. This was something that had been talked about before IRM Ref had even come around, though, was, you know, getting rid of pensions, full-time pensions for board members that attend maybe five meetings a month. But when IRMRF came around, we took a hard look, and they wanted board members to start producing as well, kind of like timesheets or documentation that they worked required hours. And obviously, a lot of them could not do that. Had a great discussion with a lot of board members and tried to rally them and say, you know, guys, this is the opportunity. This is the time for us to do what's right. Let's get rid of these benefits. They're not deserved to us. We're not full-time employees. We're supposed to be public servants. And there was some resistance from other board members. You know, they tried to come up with an excuse. Well, I'm not in the community. People talk to me. That counts as hours. And it's all part of the job, really. So we led the effort in Grundy County there, and we eliminated pensions for part-time politicians that shouldn't have been getting them in the first place.
The thing that's remarkable about this is you actually had a good idea locally that was scaled statewide. That rarely happens.
Yeah, no, it's nice to see that we saw it, something being done in Springfield, and the governor ultimately signed the bill that eliminated it. It's good practice. It's things like that that should be getting done in Springfield.
But, you know, Representative, this is a great piece of news. You know, you've got a situation where you came up with a common sense initiative, and it got bipartisan support and signed off by the governor. You know, I think it's amazing, and I find it interesting. I wish we could do more things you obviously must have some other ideas, given that this is not the only small waste that's going on in the state. So what are your next big initiatives that might find support like this?
Yeah, there's a whole slew of things in terms of improvements that we can make. Well, I've been really talking about people. Some of the governor's business reforms and his turnaround agenda. Obviously, we've seen this last session, these last couple sessions. It's been difficult to get things done with Mike Madigan's supermajority. But what's happening right now out there, if we can scale back at that, I think the governor has a fighting chance at workman's compensation, other areas that I think will help improve the business climate in Illinois. I think we have a real chance of possibly getting that down in this next session. But something I would be really passionate about, obviously, with the county board, IMRF pensions, ending those for part-time politicians, I do believe that the General Assembly members, a lot of them do treat it as a full-time job. But what frustrated me when I took office and found out was that the state doesn't really offer me a 401k style with a employee match. I'd really like to see the state of Illinois for the elected officials move away from pensions, completely end it, and move us into a 401k style. But it's important is that I think they deserve the employee match, just as any other state employee should have the ability to move to a 401k style plan with an employer match.
Yeah, I mean,
that would be something that I would be pretty passionate about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of the things. I mean, far be it from me to take everybody's money out of the pockets of all the noblemen and magistrates in Springfield. But in addition to that, while that seems to be at least a sensible midpoint to removing pension benefits for politicians, part-time politicians, whether some of these legislators consider it full-time or not, it's a part-time job. But that seems to be a good intermediate step. But in addition to that, what about something along the lines of what Comptroller Munger has proposed, which is, speaking of the job, if you don't do your job, which is to put a constitutionally balanced budget on the governor's desk, then you don't get paid at all.
Yeah, I think it would definitely motivate legislators to actually do their job. That's something that we want to sign on to as well. The comptroller right now is trying to show the people and some of the information that she's put out about where we're at in the budget, the backlog of bills. I think she's really trying to do a good job of driving home that folks, we're at a fiscal cliff here. And if we can't get our legislators to do their job, then we need to hold them accountable. That means no pay.
All right. He is State Representative David Welter, one of the representatives that represent a new generation of leadership in Springfield, long overdue. Republican from Morris, Representative Welter, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having the time. Have a great day.
Now, more stories, insights, and analysis of Illinois policy and politics. This is Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute. Once again, your host, Dan Proft.
Dan Proft back with Ted Dabrowski, Vice President of Policy at the Illinois Policy Institute. And Ted, we saw during the run-up to the budget deal, kind of the temporary deal to extend out financing of state government to the end of the year, that colleges, state colleges, universities in Illinois were crying poor, talking about having to lay off staff, some even threatening that they may have to close their doors if the state didn't arrive with the requested funding, schools like Chicago State making that claim. But it turns out if you dig into the numbers, you find some things that are a bit troubling about how we do financing of state universities and colleges in Illinois, where we are providing twice as much per student as compared to their conference peers, relative colleges, universities, so Illinois as compared to Big Ten peers, for example. And yet tuition at our state schools is at the same time between 20 and 40% higher than their conference peers. So how do we square the circle?
Well, you know, it's it becomes pretty obvious once you get into the numbers, but before that you think, hey, you know, the state is providing more aid for education, so it should be cheaper for Illinois students, but it's not. And the reason why is these universities are taking all this money, hiring more and more staff, the administrative staff at colleges, not just in Illinois, but across the country. It's just ballooned. And with that, their pay has been higher and higher. Their pensions have been crazy. And so therefore, the more money that's put into the system, it's raising the cost of the system. So what's left is higher tuitions that kids have to pay.
So
it's just unfair.
So, for example, according to the Illinois Board of Higher Education, more than half of Illinois' 2,465 university administrators have a base salary north of $100,000. And, you know, you want everybody to maximize their earnings. I don't begrudge people maximizing their earnings, but at the same time, it's the conversation we always have. It's what can we actually afford? What is respectful to the job that we're seeking to have someone do? And what can we finance both on the base salary side, plus, as you're indicating, all the added benefits?
Well, I think the other thing we have to look at is what are we funding? If we fund more and more administrators, and we saw Chicago State, actually, we found that Chicago State almost had the same number of administrators as it did faculty. So that's just way too much administration. The other thing is funding our programs that maybe don't deserve to exist. Some programs that only have six or seven people in the program itself. And so what's happened is we've ballooned it, and then we've priced it out so kids can't afford it. And I think that's the unfair thing.
Well, in Chicago State, I mean, we've talked about this on my morning show as well. Chicago State, 2009 to 2015, 6 years, 11% graduation rate. 11% over 6 years, $2.5 million per year per graduate from Chicago State. And most of that money comes from the state of Illinois. That doesn't seem like a great rate of return or a great return on the investment we're making in higher education. If you're not going to educate children, why are we pouring more money into the system? If you're going to just featherbed administrative bureaucracy, then why are we providing more money into the system? I mean, something I've suggested previously, be interested in your reaction, is look, the message the governor and the General Assembly could give to state colleges and universities is here's the deal. Going back to those peer comparisons, conference peer comparisons, you can either bring your tuition down to the median of the peer of your conference peers, or we're going to bring the state support down to the median of your conference peers. You choose. But one way or the other, we're going to stop this. We're giving you twice as much, and you're fleecing Illinois families as compared to what other states are doing with their state colleges and universities at the same time.
Well, it's not a bad idea, Dan. You know, it's got to change. You can't have a situation where the state's going bankrupt, it's spending more and more money on higher education, and at the same time, tuitions keep going up. And I think you're starting to see the change. What was interesting this past week was that you're seeing schools showing that their enrollments were going down.
Mm.
And, you know, it becomes pretty obvious to somebody who's living on the border, who's looking at Iowa, or somebody who wants to look at a nearby school, Indiana, says, wow, wait a minute, it's cheaper. I don't have to worry about this funding stuff. It's just I get a better deal.
Well, and the other thing that's happening, too, just that's driving that, is an Illinois exports more of its college-bound high school seniors than any state in the nation except New Jersey. Why is that? Because this is not a place that has economic opportunities. So if you don't have job opportunities for kids that are looking at where they're going to launch their career after college, then, you know, going to school at a reduced comparative cost in Tennessee or South Carolina or Texas starts, or Indiana or Iowa or Missouri starts to look, or Wisconsin starts to look a lot more attractive. And so people and kids go away to college and they're not coming back to a state that doesn't have job opportunities in their chosen field of endeavor.
Well, you know, I think what politicians are starting to figure out is that Illinoisans can do math.
Right? Yeah,
they're not stupid. And, you know, you can only treat them in a bad way for a certain amount of time. The same thing for administrators. They got to change the way they do things. Otherwise, people will vote with their feet. And that's what they're doing, whether it's leaving Illinois to find job opportunities or leaving Illinois to go for college.
One other thing that you've written about in terms of the pension side of this is there is a group of academics in higher ed that actually have reformed pensions, in a sense. Talk about these 17,000 or so odd university employees that have that do their pensions differently than the rest.
Yeah, so back in 1998, there was an idea, and it was a good idea, and unfortunately has been rolled out more, but there was an idea to provide professors, to give them a choice of whether they wanted the traditional pension or a 401k-style plan like everybody else in the private sector has. And we've seen that since then, you know, every year, 15 to 20% of new workers that come into the state university retirement system or to education, they're taking the 401k style plan. And that's a much better plan for them because it's not broke. And it's a much better plan for the university system because it's much more affordable, predictable, and manageable. And so we need to see more of that happen, not just the university system, but across Illinois pensions.
Restoring Illinois to greatness. This is Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute and hosted by Dan Proft.
Dan Proft back with Ted Dabrowski, Vice President of Policy at the Illinois Policy Institute. And Ted, Lane Neckrich, she's this Democrat state legislator from Northbrook, you know, another one of these men and women of always in Illinois. And she's one of these kind of North Shore types that pretends to be postpartisan, but she's really just a liberal hack. And let me give you an illustration of this so you don't find it to be an unfounded contention on my part, because I'd hate for you to do that. She said of Governor Rauner describing the reality on the ground in Illinois, the reality of our economy, the reality of our business climate, she said, "I think we can do more of selling ourselves rather than selling ourselves short." That may be nice for a T-shirt, but, you know, these kind of whimsical, falsely optimistic cliches that political ruling class types like Neckrich trot out to pretend like, you know, why so down in the dumps? Why so gloomy? If we put on a happy face, we don't have to change anything we're doing. All of a sudden, things are going to be better. We're great. You know, pay no mind to all of the quality of life indicators. I mean, it's just so tiresome. And this, she says, against the backdrop of one of our state's leading employers, Caterpillar, announcing 300 layoffs this week.
It's fascinating. You know, it just reminds you of that person who tries to sell you something, but you know that they're not telling the truth. And, you know, imagine trying to tell somebody, hey, come to Chicago. Don't worry about the crime. Don't worry about the schools. Everything's
fine.
Don't
worry about the property taxes.
Don't worry about the property taxes. Or, hey, move into Illinois and, oh, I forgot to tell you, here's your bill for the property taxes. Here's your bill for the pensions that you have to pay down because it's so high. You know, it's you got to tell the truth to people. And I think the only way you solve problems, anybody who has a real problem or has ever had a real problem, the only way you solve it is if you face it, if you admit it, and then you put a plan together.
Well, here's the problem. And not just that she's a ruling class Paul and she's a pawn of the Democrat machine. She's a wholly owned subsidiary of Mike Madigan, the Elaine Neckrich, who pretends to be one of these self-styled independents on the North Shore, who is always doing the bidding of big government Chicago Democrats. And she's one of them. She's also one of the two categories of residents that are increasingly the only cohorts left in Illinois. One are benefits of transfer payments, beneficiaries of transfer payments. Two is those who are insulated from terrible public policy decisions because of their wealth. And she's got a rich lawyer husband, works at a big downtown firm, and she's got, you know, her phony baloney job in Springfield she's had for the last decade, and the pension and all the other associated benefits. You know, so you live in Northbrook and you play this game of trying to be post-partisan and trying to work with both sides to find solutions. And, you know, in typical fashion, she's only been there a decade plus. So, you know, that's not enough of a probationary period to judge whether Elaine Neckrich is actually part of trying to reverse course in Illinois and improve people's quality of life and solve some of the problems that we all recognize. So we've got to give her more time to spew these fortune cookie bromides.
Well, I think, you know, if she could say some of those things if she were one of the bold reformers. You know, it's one thing if you're saying, hey, we have problems, but we also have great assets in Illinois. And we know those great assets that we have. But if she were the bold reformer that was trying to transform the property tax issue that's killing people, the manufacturing losses that are just destroying the state and in the working class, the higher and higher taxes and the pension problem we have. But she's not a leader in those things. She's right there with Madigan and keeping the status quo. So she has no right, I think, to say what she's saying.
Right. And at some point, it would be nice if all those uber-educated denizens of the North Shore would stop falling for the same rap over and over again, where your local Democrat hack legislators trot out the reform rhetoric and they go to Springfield and they're just another brick in the wall.